Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard Seascapes, your maritime programme. This week, our special guest is the Flag Officer commanding the Naval Service, Commodore Mark Mallette. Seascapes recently visited Haulbowline Island and the impressive Naval Service headquarters across from Cove in Cork Harbour. We talked about the work of the Irish Naval Service, IMERC, the National Maritime College of Ireland, new arrivals due in the fleet, our extensive coastline and the vast sea area which is Irish territory. So let's hear from Commodore Mark Mallette, Officer Commanding the Naval Service.
Well, we're extremely lucky to have such good infrastructure on the island of Haulbowline. There's a lot more to be done, and I know the government is moving ahead with its plans to clean up in the context of the East Tip and look at rejuvenating the island. But what we have, if you look out the window here, you just see that castle just at the top of the island there, and that is the actual home of the Water Club of Cork in 1720. And just under 7 years' time, we'll have the 300th anniversary of the establishment of the first yacht club in the world, which is now obviously located in the Royal Cork Yacht Club. So we're hoping to partner with them in terms of development there. But in terms of infrastructure, Haulbowline was also home to the army. The British army were based here, and the navy came afterwards, and they established a fine dockyard area, some fine buildings in terms of storehouses here on the island itself. And we occupy a number of those, and from those our operations and support command headquarters deliver support to the fleet of 8 ships, which patrol from here, giving up to between 1480 and 1680 patrol days per year. Our area of jurisdiction, as you know, is huge. It's between 12 and 13 times the size of the landmass, the largest maritime to land ratio in Northwest Europe. And it's an area in which our ships, and as we speak in a moment, we have 4 ships patrolling that side, men and women of the service, delivering government defence and public services on behalf of the citizens. We are the maritime element defence, and accordingly we work closely with the Army and we work closely with the Air Corps in terms of our primary role and our strategic end state, which is to protect and enhance Ireland's national interests at and from the sea.
How many are in the Naval Service today? Because I'll give you this statistic that somebody said to me in Dunleary not so long ago, there are more members in the Royal St. George Yacht Club than there are members of the Navy. Now, I was staggered by that, but obviously you've a great complement of men and women, and great to see so many women in the service.
Yeah, we've just over 1,000 at the moment in the service. We have an establishment for about 1,194. We're continually, I suppose, racing to keep up in that we have a throughput of people who join the service, give a number of years service and then move on outside. And we have a very good training and development regime within the Navy itself, because we see ourselves not just making mariners and competence for the military and the Navy. We also see us gifting people who are developed back to society with honed maritime skills in which they can actually contribute to the economy in general and to public service in general outside the military. So 1,000 or 1,020, as we are at the moment, is a small number in the context of the variety and diversity of services we have to deliver. Like, our footprint is not just in terms of national interests, in terms of the waters where we have sovereignty or sovereign rights. It's anywhere where the government has an interest. So our ships have been as far east as Tokyo, as far west as Mexico, as far south as Punta Arenas in South America, and as far north as Reykjavik in Iceland. So we are able to carry the flag, and you see it up there, the masthead, which is the statement of Irish sovereignty, wherever the government has an interest or wherever it has a need to actually support government policy at home and abroad. We have supported the Army in terms of overseas service. I think the first reconnaissance mission into Liberia was from a naval ship, Elie Neave, and that reconnaissance team went in, the ship sailed down, and they disembarked from the ship and established the base for the camp in Liberia at that time. But if we look at it in the context of the utility of the service, and I'm glad you mentioned members of Ireland who founded Navies Abroad, Admiral Brown, who's a fellow Mayo man, I was delighted to be able to travel to South America in 2006 with the Etna and participate in celebrations there in advance of the 150th anniversary of Admiral Brown's death. And it is remarkable to see the actual esteem in which Brown is held. You know, South America, and in particular Argentina, is a country that actually understands the value of the maritime to it in terms of its success. It also sees the value of the maritime in terms of the development of the state. And I think many countries, you know, really appreciate and understand that sea lines of communications are, if you like, the arteries in terms of globalized trade. It's essential for our economy. And in fact, in this country here, few people understand that 99% of our trade travels by sea. And it's critically important in terms of the economy that sea lines of communications are actually secure. And that's the role of the service itself. And if you go back to even Mahan in terms of US Navy, he understood that fully. Whoever controls the sea controls commerce. And that's basically it from the point of view of the economy we have in the world today. And we see the impact in terms of Somalia, for instance, whereby pirates can actually interfere with trade. We've had issues with regards to vessels moving through that area that have been interfered with. Fortunately, that has decreased somewhat now in response to the EU NAVFOR efforts in the region. But you can never rest. I'm just watching with interest in terms of the Gulf of Guinea at the moment, the rise in criminality in terms of interference with trade at sea. And it's something that we have to be, I suppose, on our guard with. So it is a role of the Navy in particular in terms of our national jurisdiction and the area where we have sovereign rights to be, if you like, servants of the state in terms of underpinning good governance at sea. And good governance is about ensuring that good actors can get about their business in a safe and secure environment. But it's also about ensuring that bad actors are not of a mind to do anything that undermines national laws, regional laws, and international law. Peter Heffernan, you know, coined the phrase of 220 million acres out of sight but not out of mind, and that's the point. We have to actually join in, and I think, you know, the current understanding now is that we have lodged our claims with the Commission on Limits of Continental Shelf in New York in 2007 and 2009, and that's given us a jurisdiction now of almost 1 million square kilometres, where the citizens of this state have property rights over the seabed and subseabed resources. And that's a massive area in terms of area where the state has jurisdiction and where the area state has an interest. Going back to the point in regards to delivery of governance, we work very closely, of course, with the Customs and Revenue. We work very closely with An Garda Síochána. We are part of the Joint Task Force, which is specifically focused in terms of counter-narcotics. And we work as a partner with the Gardaí and the Customs in that area. But we also work in terms of looking at other areas of resource management in the context of fisheries in particular. And we actually work closely with the Sea Fishery Protection Authority. In fact, we have service level agreements with about 20 different institutions in the state, whereby we provide support to those institutions. And these are separate to some degree in terms of our core military function, which is the maritime element of the Defence Forces, working with the Air Corps and working with the Army in terms of ensuring that we're poised to deliver defence services if they are required. So the day-to-day, if you like, default position is delivery of government and public services. The area where we have jurisdiction over is one of the richest fisheries in the North Atlantic. So it is a challenge in terms of ensuring that actors who work in that area or come up to fish in that area are conforming with the common fisheries policy. I often say the point is this, that the transfer in terms of the resource of the fish from our jurisdiction to other states is only legitimate if the fish are caught in accordance with the common fisheries policy. Any fish that are, if you like, black landed or high graded or taken out of the area, not in accordance with the common fisheries policy, are in fact a theft from the citizens of the state. So it's very important that we protect the resource and ensure that those who fish in the area are conforming with the institutional requirements of the common fisheries policy. Well, we're very conscious of the force multiplier that new technology can bring. And under the Irish Maritime and Energy Resource Cluster, we've built a number of partnerships with commercial entities and with research communities, in particular with University College Cork and Cork Institute of Technology. And we're looking in terms of that three-legged stool, I call it, the end user, which is the Navy lead user, end user innovator, looking at end user driven solutions to end user identified problems. And when you're in, you know, our business at sea, you have time to reflect about additional capability that if you could develop it, how much it would enhance your ability to deliver services. So we're continually ground-truthing what we're doing with a view to, is there something we can do to enhance our capability? And when you see new opportunities and you actually can link up with the research community, whether it be in Cork Institute of Technology or whether it be in University College Cork, whether it would be with 4C, which is the Computer Constraint Centre in University College Cork or Tyndall, or with Nimbus out in Cork Institute of Technology, you often get unique partnerships that can develop new types of technology. And the real magic then is when you bring in, you have a spin out, maybe like SeaTech or SkyTech, small companies that spin out of the actual partnership that actually start harnessing the actual product of the end-user driven solution to an end-user identified problem. And the added value of this also, it's also a cause of attraction for foreign direct investment companies. And we have a number of FDI companies from the US and hopefully from Germany coming in soon. And we also have further in the pipeline that actually are coming to cluster around this concept. Because it is the way to actually allow us within the service, working closely with the Defence Enterprise Committee in Newbridge, to actually get capability that is actually created in this state and actually at the same time contributes to job creation and ultimately contributes to the economy. I'm glad you mentioned Halpin, because Halpin is a great success story in terms of the National Maritime College of Ireland, which is a partnership between the Irish Navy and Cork Institute of Technology with a private partner in terms of both as lend-lease. But the Halpin Centre has been stood up and it is focused on a number of key areas of value to us. And more recently, as you mentioned, also the Beaufort Centre was launched, the Taoiseach turned the sod on it. And underpinning that also is the Science Foundation Ireland Award of a €25 million award with over 40 companies that are actually going to be partnering in Science Foundation Ireland Award for the MARI project, which is focused on marine renewables. Getting back to our ships, yes, we're very fortunate that we have two ships being built as we speak. I last May visited Samuel Beckett, which is due to be floated out in October, and she will be here with us in early 2014. A remarkable ship, a great achievement at a very cost-effective price. When I look at her compared to some units built in other navies and other jurisdictions, you can be talking about up to a billion euro for a warship these days, and we're getting our ship now significantly less than that. And it is a statement in terms of the support for the naval service from government at this time when finances are constrained. But that's part of a replacement program. You know, six of our eight ships are now at or over 30 years of age, and their life is such that it is beginning to become uneconomic to keep them going. So I'm delighted that we have two ships on the way to replace two of those six ships. And that will mean that we have more capability and an ability to operate in our sea area, which is statistically the roughest sea in the Northern Hemisphere. The largest wave ever measured by a scientific instrument was back in about 2000 when the UK research vessel Discovery measured a wave about 450 miles off the northwest Mayo coast at 29.1 metres, an extraordinary wave. And that wave was not actually consistent with the patterns that they expected. It actually was bigger. It may well have been a rogue wave, but there were a number of them at that stage measured by scientific instrument. So it has caused some reflection in terms of some of the models they use for measuring waves or for predicting waves, that actually the models aren't quite forecasting the extremes. And we often come across these waves ourselves when we're operating in the jurisdiction. And if we need evidence as to why we need well-found ships, it's simply the fact that we work in a very hostile sea area. And it's not much value to society if we have a navy that cannot get out to sea because it's too rough. because bad things happen when the weather is bad. And often we have to be in an area whereby we're poised for a particular operation, or we have to respond to delivery support to the Coast Guard in terms of search and rescue operations, or we're watching in terms of a vessel that might be in difficulty that may be a pollution risk, and we have to actually monitor that with a view to ensuring that the state's interests are upheld. The National Maritime College of Ireland was a game changer for the Navy. If I look back in my early time when I joined the Navy, we were always innovative. We were very, very good at, you know, coming up with creative solutions to problems we had. When we joined with Cork Institute of Technology and the National Maritime College of Ireland was created, we moved into what I would call open innovation. We began to actually create partnerships with the likes of Cork Institute of Technology. We began to mix with the Merchant Navy. We found that actually we had a huge amount in common. And we found also that very often we would have a difficulty or a problem that we didn't have the solution for within the Naval Service itself. But one of our partners, either in the Merchant Navy or in Cork Institute of Technology, was able to provide us with a solution to that. And this is, you know, this has increased since then now with the expansion of the Irish Maritime and Energy Resource Cluster. I suppose the beauty about having a third-level institution like National Maritime College of Ireland is that it is a well-respected educational platform. And the number of officers now coming into the service, they all go through the National Maritime College. And you're right in terms of the mix. Over 25% of our officers within the Naval Service now are female. So we would have the highest proportion in Western Europe. And just recently we had a lovely ceremony down in Waterford where we had a ship's command on Eli Aoife, where the outgoing captain, Lieutenant Commander Erica Downing, handed over to the incoming captain, Lieutenant Commander Marie Gleeson. People might say, well, so what's the issue? And there is no issue, but the point I would say is it is nice to see that we are increasing the actual gender balance within the defence forces, and in particular the Naval Service is actually, I suppose, championing that in terms of number of females within the organisation. I think traditionally the numbers of females on ships at sea has been relatively low, and that is changing. The National Maritime College is a great third-level institution from the point of view of developing our personnel. At present, we have every junior leader within the Navy is getting a level 6. Every senior non-commissioned officer gets a degree. Every junior officer is now moving towards an honours degree. We have a master's programme there. And we have a number of personnel who have embarked on work-based learning PhD programme within the Naval Service, supported by our partners in Cork Institute of Technology. And this is about learning which was in the organisation. It's about work-based learning in the main, where people are actually reflecting on the things they do day in, day out. And through our partnership with Cork Institute of Technology, who have delegated autonomy for accreditation with HETEC, the awards are being made once they meet the requirements and standards set down by HETEC and overseen by Cork Institute of Technology. It is about creating knowledge. It's about ensuring that the Navy has codified a lot of the practices in the past that would, to some degree, we have invested in terms of the organisation building up this knowledge, but the individual didn't get a certificate as a consequence. And when they leave the organisation, they were not certified. But now we've managed, through our partnership, to ensure people within the service are being recognised for the amount of learning they have to do in the context of their day job. And this is of value to them personally now in terms of ensuring that it is accredited. Dr. Val Cummins is a remarkable leader. She really has done so much in terms of pulling together this complex institutional arrangement with Cork Institute of Technology, University College Cork, the Irish Naval Service. And she provided that leadership on a number of norms and principles which are about trust, about reciprocity, about collaboration and about communications. But it's this her manner in terms of actually thinking strategically and actually managing this complex relationship that has actually really bearing fruit at present. And the number of companies that are coming into the cluster and the manner in which she has brought her knowledge in terms of a researcher and the leader of the CMRC before she came into the IMERC cluster is really bearing fruit. And you mentioned Peter Heffernan, who has also provided that leadership. Dr. Peter Heffernan really has, through the Marine Institute, brought the understanding in terms of the value of the Marine to the centre. And that's critically important because the Marine needs advocates. You know, there aren't many people, you know, standing on the Porcupine Bank at the moment who are in a position to articulate what the value of the Porcupine Bank is, or Rockall Hatton. you know, the issue, I think, in terms of, I suppose, society and the citizen, they need to hear the story with regards to the wealth that Ireland has got in the context of its maritime domain. And it is people like Dr. Valerie Cummins, it is people like Dr. Peter Heffernan, who are really, I suppose, setting the agenda in terms of our lost heritage to some degree in terms of Ireland's maritime heritage. You know, if you look back to Grainne Whale, you know, she understood in terms of the value of the maritime, in terms of how it actually could be used to outmaneuver quite strong forces. You go back to St. Brendan, he understood the actual ability of a sea line of communications to bring it to new territories. And you go to Admiral William Brown, who founded the Argentine Navy. Ireland is not shy in terms of maritime heroes. It's not shy in terms of, in the past, of having people who actually understood the maritime. But I think since independence, to some degree, there has been a certain sea blindness. And over the last 90 years or nearly 100 years or so, that sea blindness has, to some degree, constrained the opportunity that the maritime can bring for this state. And I'm glad to hear that that's changing now. And I'm glad to hear, you know, it been said regularly that for too long we turned our backs to the sea, and it's now time to look to the sea. You know, we only get at the present 1.2% of our GDP from the maritime sector. UK gets 5%, Belgium gets 8%, Denmark gets 11%, Norway gets 20%. And yet we have the largest sea-to-land ratio in Northwest Europe. Just think of the opportunity in terms of the economic growth potential. So it's great to see the government has launched our ocean wealth with a view to harnessing that wealth from our jurisdiction, the area where we have sovereign rights over seabed and subseabed resources, sovereign rights over resources in the water column within our exclusive economic zone. So I think that things are changing in terms of the maritime in this state. We're finally beginning to come back to our roots and see that we are an island nation gifted with a huge maritime resource that actually has the potential to provide wealth and security for the citizens of this state. I'm glad that the Credna is well-found, and I have a great love for the Credna. When I joined the Navy as a cadet, one of my first sea trips was on the Credna and with Eric, and we sailed to France. It's really the way to get salt in your veins is to go on a sailing vessel, because, you know, a ship will give you a certain level, but it doesn't bring you down to brass tacks as much as a sailing boat will. And Credna, we've put some invested in bringing her to a level now where she is fit for purpose. And we're currently looking at her in terms of the management of her, to use her for sail training, not just for the service, but supporting others in terms of who may require berths, as we currently don't have a sail training vessel in the state at present. So there are a number of initiatives, I think, looking at how we might further develop the resources of the state for sail training. But certainly from the service point of view, Credna is a resource that we're ready to provide limited support within the resources allocated to service. We're very fortunate that in 2012 we took in about 130 recruits, and we're hoping to take in recruits in 2013. The challenge, obviously, in terms of the public finances is that recruitment within the public sector in general always has to be based on a needs must. But ultimately, if you don't have a crew for a ship won't sail. So within the service, in terms of our overall cap of 1,094, we're hoping to recruit up towards that in the coming 12 months or so. It's essential that we actually have personnel to man our ships, because people move on from the service itself. And as I said, we're approaching 1,000 at present. So we hopefully will have recruits before the end of this year that will ensure that the new ships coming on stream will have fish trained personnel to man those ships. You know, there is, I suppose, a desire in many people's futures to actually be involved in the maritime. And I would just make the point that, you know, in terms of the institution arrangement we have with CIT, in terms of the National Maritime College in particular, it is a remarkable career choice for somebody who wants adventure, who basically wants variety, who wants diversity in the context of what they do. And ultimately, you know, in joining the military, we have a proud tradition in terms of servicing the requirements of the state. And we have a proud tradition in terms of working closely with the Army and the Air Corps in terms of ensuring that the national interests are upheld and furthered with a view to ensuring the sovereignty of the state.
You're listening to Seascapes on RT Radio 1. Our guest this week is Commodore Mark Millett, Flag Officer Commanding Naval Service. We wondered about his earliest encounter with the sea.
My first real encounter would have been going fishing with my grandfather up in Lough Carra in Mayo. And subsequently, we had a small boat down in Killary in Leenane, and I began to get the taste of salt water as we used to travel down at weekends from Castlebar down to Leenane. And then I joined the FCA at that time. There was a famous character called Mick Considine, who actually brought the FCA, the 5th Motor Squadron, out on a sailing trip out of Rosmina in near Westport. And I really enjoyed it. And, you know, after that, the rest is history. I joined the Naval Service, enjoyed sailing initially, enjoyed the bigger ships then as I developed. And it really is something else that's very peaceful at the end of the day, being at sea. You know, you're there with your thoughts. And in terms of service in the Navy, it can be moments of boredom, you know, interspersed with total periods of chaos and excitement as you're, you know, poised to catch a drug smuggler, or you're in a position whereby you're tracking maybe somebody with an illegal cargo, or you're actually at that point whereby, and I just reflecting on the tragedy of the Astra day recently, I remember as a young ship's captain along that very, very coast just off Kinsale there, searching for a number of two people whose boat had sunk. And it really was a very difficult time because it was a lee shore, a very strong southerly gale, and we really thought they were lost. And I remember, fortunately, about 6 o'clock in the morning, we found them up on the rocks and managed to take them off and brought them home safely. So the variety which, you know, a service within the military and in the naval service in particular gives you can be extraordinary. And it's actually, it's a variety and a choice that I think many people would really enjoy. And you don't necessarily have to have, if you like, a tradition in terms of being involved in the sea. I think about 8 or 9 in every 10 would love to go to sea and make a good career of it. What we have done, as you may be aware, is all our recruit classes are called after a naval hero. And it's a way we've actually, within the service, tried to do our bit to institutionalise that maritime heritage that in many cases has been forgotten. But going back to naval heroes, you know, my own naval hero is William Brown. And if you look at it in terms of what he achieved, by any measure, is quite remarkable. I was in Philadelphia recently, where it was one of the first stops in terms of Brown's trip as a youngster, about 7 or 8, where he went over there with his father, and his father passed away and he was left orphaned. But he actually met up with a sea captain then, and that's where his career started as a mariner. But if you look at it in terms of the literature and look at what Brown achieved, he was a real innovator, you know, before the word was probably ever invented. He was able to get so much out of so little. But the real character with regards to Brown was a character linked to leadership. He was a man who understood men. He understood the importance of the value of the youngest sailor on board his ship. And he did not stand on pomp and ceremony. He rolled up his sleeves, he provided the leadership, and his men followed him. And accordingly, he was able to do remarkable things with very, very little resources. And in many ways, he has set an example for ourselves in the Irish Navy, whereby we have limited resources. But if you look at it in the context of what really the force multiplier is in terms of the delivery of output, ultimately, it's about people. So we in the Navy haven't got aircraft carriers, or we don't have Tomahawk cruise missile systems. We don't have submarines. But we have is people that I'm certain are better and certainly as good as the people in any other Navy. And it's our job within the leadership of the organization to ensure that our people within the Navy develop towards our vision, which is to be the smartest, most innovative, and most responsive naval service provider in the world by 2016. And I'm certain we can deliver on that, because if we focus on developing our people as the force multipliers for the resources we get, you can have an extraordinary outcome in terms of what can be achieved. We all join any organization with a certain amount of baggage, a certain amount of uncertainty, a certain amount of, I suppose, of confidence and maybe lack of confidence. But the one thing I found in joining the military, it gave me the confidence to actually have an understanding of what I could do and what I couldn't do. It gave me a confidence in my competence to be able to provide a level of leadership that is required for the organization. But it also gave me the humility to understand that it's not about just the leader of the organization. It's about the youngest serviceman or servicewoman that comes into the organization. It's about a recognition that the value of those individuals is critical towards you in ensuring that the outcomes required for the organization are achieved. And it's also about remembering one thing, that nobody should feel uncomfortable in the workplace, so that everybody should feel valued, and that everybody should feel that they can make a contribution to the outcomes required in the organization itself. So I often talk about myself as the wrinkly old Commodore, but in terms of the organization, I'm no more important than the youngest sailor that has come in, because he's or she is going to be the sustaining of the Navy into the future. To some degree, within the leadership of the Navy itself, we're only temporary custodians of the service itself. You know, there really are three navies. There's the Navy of yesterday, which actually gifted us the Navy of today, and there's the Navy of tomorrow. And it's our job within the leadership of the Navy to ensure that when we hand over the service to our successors, that it is well-found, it is properly resourced, and that the procedures and the doctrine that are in the Navy are built on an understanding that we would go to sea on ships on behalf of the citizens and behalf of government with a view to ensuring Ireland's national interests are upheld and protected.
Our thanks to Commodore Mark Millett, Flag Officer Commanding the Naval Service. On the day that she's been decommissioned, the Ellie Eimear offshore patrol vessel, built in Vrome Dockyard in 1978, will be sold by auction by Dominic Daly by direction of the Department of Defence on the 23rd of October in the Carrigaline Court Hotel. We'll have more on Seascapes in the coming weeks. Next Friday night, here on Seascapes, we hear the remarkable story of marine engineer Fred Parl, who has travelled the world's oceans. He was kidnapped by Somali pirates in 2008 and is writing his memoirs of his time in captivity. So, until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.